Rungs on the opportunity ladder may have been more slippery for blacks. The admittance of Latinos into firehouses and corporate suites may have been grudging. But despite all that, the combination of economic growth, government investment in broad-based programs to encourage upward mobility, and a modest commitment to enforce the simple principle of non-discrimination was sufficient to pull the large majority of blacks and Latinos into the socioeconomic mainstream within a generation. We need to remind ourselves of this achievement. What's remarkable is not the number of minorities who have failed to climb into the middle class, but the number who succeeded against the odds. Not the anger and bitterness that parents of color have transmitted to their children, but the degree to which such emotions have ebbed. That knowledge gives us something to build on. It tells us that more progress can be made. If universal strategies that target the challenges facing all Americans can go a long way towards closing the gap between blacks, Latinos, and whites, there are two aspects of race relations in America that require special attention, issues that fan the flames of racial conflict and undermine the progress that's been made. With respect to the African-American community, the issue is the deteriorating condition of the inner-city poor. With respect to Latinos, it is the problem of undocumented workers and the political firestorm surrounding immigration. I hear a sentiment in the African-American community these days that conditions in the heart of the inner city are spinning out of control. Sometimes the conversation will center on statistics, the infant mortality rate, say, or black male unemployment, or the number of black men who can expect to go through the criminal justice system at some point in their lives. But more often the conversation focuses on personal stories, offered as evidence of a fundamental breakdown within a portion of our community, and voiced with a mixture of sadness and incredulity. A teacher will talk about what it's like to have an 8-year-old shout obscenities and threaten her with bodily harm. A public defender will describe a 15-year-old's harrowing rap sheet, or the nonchalance with which his clients predict they will not live to see their 30th year. A pediatrician will describe the teenage parents who don't think there's anything wrong with feeding their toddlers potato chips for breakfast, or who admit to having left their 5- or 6-year-olds alone at home. These are the stories of those who didn't make it out of history's confinement, of the neighborhoods within the black community that house the poorest of the poor, serving as repositories for all the scars of slavery and violence of Jim Crow, the internalized rage and the forced ignorance, the shame of men who could not protect their women or support their families, the children who grew up being told they wouldn't amount to anything and had no one there to undo the damage. There was a time, of course, when such deep intergenerational poverty could still shock a nation. Not anymore. Today, the images of the so-called underclass are ubiquitous, a permanent fixture in American popular culture. Rather than evoke our sympathy, our familiarity with the lives of the black poor has bred spasms of fear and outright contempt, but mostly it's bred indifference. Black men filling our prisons, black children unable to read or caught in a gangland shooting, the black homeless sleeping on grates and in the parks of our nation's capital. We take these things for granted, as part of the natural order, a tragic situation perhaps, but not one for which we are culpable, and certainly not something subject to change. This concept of a black underclass, separate, apart, alien in its behavior and in its values, has also played a central role in modern American politics. It was partly on behalf of fixing the black ghetto that Johnson's War on Poverty was launched, and it was on the basis of that war's failures, both real and perceived, that conservatives turned much of the country against the very concept of the welfare state. A cottage industry grew within conservative think tanks, arguing not only that cultural pathologies, rather than racism or structural inequalities built into our economy, were responsible for black poverty, but that government programs like welfare, coupled with liberal judges who coddled criminals, actually made these pathologies worse. On television, images of innocent children with distended bellies were replaced with those of black looters and muggers. News reports focused less on the black maid struggling to make ends meet and more on the quote-unquote welfare queen who had babies just to collect a check. What was needed, conservatives argued, was a stern dose of discipline, more police, more prisons, more personal responsibility, and an end to welfare. If such strategies could not transform the black ghetto, at least they would contain it and keep hardworking taxpayers from throwing good money after bad. That conservatives won over white public opinion should come as no surprise. Their arguments tapped into a distinction between a deserving and undeserving poor that has a long, varied history in America, an argument that has often been racially or ethnically tinged, and that has gained greater currency during those periods, like the 70s and 80s, when economic times are tough. The response of liberal policymakers and civil rights leaders didn't help. In their urgency to avoid blaming the victims of historic discrimination, they tended to downplay or ignore evidence that entrenched behavioral patterns among the black poor really were contributing to intergenerational poverty. Most famously, Daniel Patrick Moynihan was accused of racism in the early 60s when he raised the alarms about the rise of out-of-wedlock births among the black poor. This willingness to dismiss the role that values played in shaping the economic success of a community strained credulity and alienated working-class whites, particularly since some of the most liberal policymakers lived lives far removed from urban disorder. The truth is, such rising frustration with conditions in the inner city was hardly restricted to whites. In most black neighborhoods, law-abiding, hard-working residents have been demanding more aggressive police protection for years, since they are far more likely to be victims of crime. In private, around kitchen tables, in barber shops, and after church, black folks can often be heard bemoaning eroding work ethics, inadequate parenting, and declining sexual mores with a fervor that would make the Heritage Foundation proud. In that sense, black attitudes regarding the sources of chronic poverty are far more conservative than black politics would care to admit. What you won't hear, though, are blacks using such terms as predator in describing a young gang member, or underclass in describing mothers on welfare, language that divides the world between those who are worthy of our concern and those who are not. For black Americans, such separation from the poor is never an option, and not just because the color of our skin and the conclusions the larger society draws from our color makes all of us only as free, only as respected, as are the least of us. It's also because blacks know the backstory to the inner city's dysfunction. Most blacks remember the collective story of the Great Migration from the South, how after arriving in the North, blacks were forced into ghettos because of racial steering and restricted covenants, and stacked up in public housing because no one wanted blacks living anywhere else, where the schools were substandard and the parks were underfunded and police protection was non-existent and the drug trade was tolerated. We remember how the plum patronage jobs were reserved for other immigrant groups and the blue-collar jobs that black folks relied on evaporated so that what had been intact families began to crack under the pressure, and what had been ordinary children slipped through those cracks until a tipping point was reached, and what had once been the sad exception somehow became the rule. In other words, African Americans understand that culture matters, but that culture is shaped by circumstance. We know that many in the inner city are trapped by their own self-destructive behaviors, but that those behaviors are not innate. And because of that knowledge, the black community remains convinced that if America finds its will to do so, then circumstances for those trapped in the inner city can be changed, and individual attitudes among the poor will change in kind, and the damage can gradually be undone, if not for this generation, then at least for the next. Such wisdom might help us move beyond ideological bickering and serve as the basis for a renewed effort to tackle the problems of inner city poverty. We could begin by acknowledging that perhaps the single biggest thing we could do to reduce such poverty is to encourage teen girls to finish high school and avoid having children out of wedlock. In this effort, school and community-based programs that have a proven track record of reducing teen pregnancy need to be expanded. But parents, clergy, and community leaders also need to speak out more consistently on the issue. We should also acknowledge that conservatives and Bill Clinton were right about welfare as it was previously structured. By detaching income from work, and by making no demands on welfare recipients other than a tolerance for intrusive bureaucracy, the old AFDC program sapped people of their initiative and eroded their self-respect. Any strategy to reduce intergenerational poverty has to be centered on work, not welfare. Not only because work provides independence and income, but because work provides order, structure, dignity, and opportunities for growth in people's lives. But we also need to admit that work alone does not assure that people can rise out of poverty. Across America, welfare reform has sharply reduced the number of people on the public dole. It has also swelled the ranks of the working poor, with women churning in and out of the labor market, locked into jobs that don't pay a living wage, forced every day to scramble for adequate child care, affordable housing, accessible health care, only to find themselves at the end of each month wondering how they can stretch the last few dollars that they have left to cover the food bill, the gas bill, and the baby's new coat. Strategies like an expanded earned income tax credit that help all low-wage workers can make an enormous difference in the lives of these women and their children. But if we're serious about breaking the cycle of intergenerational poverty, then many of these women will need some extra help with the basics that those living outside the inner city often take for granted. They need more police and more effective community policing in their neighborhoods to provide them and their children some semblance of personal security. They need access to community-based health centers that emphasize prevention, including reproductive care, nutritional counseling, and in some cases treatment for substance abuse. They need a radical transformation of the schools their children attend and access to affordable child care that will allow them to hold a full-time job or pursue their education. And in many cases, they need help learning to be effective parents. By the time many inner-city children reach the school system, they're already behind, unable to identify basic numbers, colors, or the letters in the alphabet, unaccustomed to sitting still or participating in a structured environment, and often burdened by undiagnosed health problems. They're unprepared not because they're unloved, but because their mothers don't know how to provide what they need. Well-structured government programs, prenatal counseling, access to regular pediatric care, parenting programs, and quality early childhood education programs have a proven ability to help fill the void. Finally, we need to tackle the nexus of unemployment and crime in the inner city so that the men who live there can begin fulfilling their responsibilities. The conventional wisdom is that most unemployed inner-city men could find jobs if they really wanted to work, that they inevitably prefer drug dealing, with its attendant risks but potential profits, to the low-paying jobs that their lack of skills warrant. In fact, economists who have studied the issue, and the young men whose fates are at stake, will tell you that the costs and benefits of the street life don't match the popular mythology. At the bottom or even the middle ranks of the industry, drug dealing is a minimum wage affair. For many inner-city men, what prevents gainful employment is not simply the absence of motivation to get off the streets, but the absence of a job history or any marketable skills, and increasingly, the stigma of a prison record. Government could kickstart a transformation of circumstances for these men by working with private sector contractors to hire and train ex-felons on projects that can benefit the community as a whole, insulating homes and offices to make them energy efficient, perhaps, or laying the broadband lines needed to thrust entire communities into the internet age. Such programs would cost money, of course, although given the annual cost of incarcerating an inmate, any drop in recidivism would help the program pay for itself. Not all of the hardcore unemployed would prefer entry-level jobs to life on the streets, and no program to help ex-felons will eliminate the need to lock up hardened criminals, those whose habits of violence are too deeply entrenched. Still, we can assume that with lawful work available for young men now in the drug trade, crime in many communities would drop. That as a consequence, more employers would locate businesses in these neighborhoods and a self-sustaining economy would begin to take root. That over the course of 10 or 15 years, norms would begin to change. Young men and women would begin to imagine a future for themselves. Marriage rates would rise, and children would have a more stable world in which to grow up. What would that be worth to us? An America in which crime has fallen, and more children are cared for, and cities are reborn, and the biases, fear, and discord that black poverty feeds is slowly drained away. It's hard to quantify the benefits of such changes, precisely because the benefits would be immeasurable. If the problems of inner-city poverty arise from our failure to face up to an often tragic past, the challenges of immigration spark fears of an uncertain future. The demographics of America are changing inexorably and at lightning speed, and the claims of new immigrants won't fit neatly into the black and white paradigm of discrimination and resistance and guilt and recrimination. Across the country, the classic immigrant story is playing itself out. The story of ambition and adaptation, hard work and education, assimilation and upward mobility. Except today's immigrants are living out this story in hyperdrive. As beneficiaries of a nation more tolerant and more worldly than the one immigrants faced generations ago, a nation that has come to revere its immigrant myth, they are more confident in their place here, more assertive of their rights. As a senator, I receive countless invitations to address these newest Americans, where I'm often quizzed on my foreign policy views. Where do I stand on Cyprus, say, or the future of Taiwan? They may have policy concerns specific to fields in which their ethnic groups are heavily represented. Indian American pharmacists might complain about Medicare reimbursements. Korean small business owners might lobby for changes in the tax code. But mostly they want affirmation that they too are Americans. Whenever I appear before immigrant audiences, I can count on some good-natured ribbing from my staff after my speech. According to them, my remarks always follow a three-part structure. I am your friend, your, fill in the home country, has been a cradle of civilization, and you embody the American dream. They're right. My message is simple. For what I've come to understand is that my mere presence before these newly minted Americans serves notice that they matter, that they are voters critical to my success, and full-fledged citizens deserving of respect. Of course, not all my conversations in immigrant communities follow this easy pattern. In the wake of 9/11, my meetings with Arab and Pakistani Americans, for example, have a more urgent quality, for the stories of detentions and FBI questioning and hard stares from neighbors have shaken their sense of security and belonging. It's in my meetings with the Latino community, though, in neighborhoods like Pilsen and Little Village, towns like Cicero and Aurora, that I'm forced to reflect on the meaning of America, the meaning of citizenship, and my sometimes conflicted feelings about all the changes that are taking place. Of course, the presence of Latinos in Illinois, Puerto Ricans, Colombians, Salvadorans, Cubans, and most of all Mexicans, dates back generations when agricultural workers began making their way north and joined ethnic groups and factory jobs throughout the region. Like other immigrants, they assimilated into the culture. Although like African Americans, their upward mobility was often hampered by racial bias. Shortly after my arrival in Chicago, my own ties to the Latino community were formed. As a young organizer, I often worked with Latino leaders on issues that affected both black and brown residents, from failing schools to illegal dumping to unimmunized children. By the time I returned from law school, new tensions between black and Latinos in Chicago had started to surface. Between 1990 and 2000, the Spanish-speaking population in Chicago rose by 38%, and with this surge in population, the Latino community was no longer content to serve as junior partner in any black-brown coalition. As black businesses and commercial strips struggled, Latino businesses thrived, helped in part by financial ties to home countries and by a customer base held captive by language barriers. Everywhere, it seemed, Mexican and Central American workers came to dominate low-wage work that had once gone to blacks, as waiters and busboys, as hotel maids, and as bellmen. And they made inroads in construction trades that had long excluded black labor. Blacks began to grumble, feel threatened. They wondered if once again they were about to be passed over by those who'd just arrived. There's no denying that many blacks share the same anxieties as many whites about the wave of illegal immigration flooding our southern border. The number of immigrants added to the labor force every year is of a magnitude not seen in this country for over a century. If this huge influx of mostly low-skill workers provides some benefits to the economy as a whole, it also threatens to depress further the wages of blue-collar Americans and puts strains on an already overburdened safety net. For most Americans, though, concerns over illegal immigration go deeper than worries about economic displacement and are more subtle than simple racism. In the past, immigration occurred on America's terms. The welcome mat could be extended selectively on the basis of the immigrant's skills or color or the needs of industry. The laborer, whether Chinese or Russian or Greek, found himself a stranger in a strange land, severed from his home country, subject to often harsh constraints, forced to adapt to rules not of his own making. Today, it seems those terms no longer apply. Immigrants are entering as a result of porous borders rather than any systematic government policy. Mexico's proximity, as well as the desperate poverty of so many of its people, suggests the possibility that border crossings cannot even be slowed, much less stopped. Satellites, calling cards, and wire transfers, as well as the sheer size of the burgeoning Latino market, make it easier for today's immigrant to maintain linguistic and cultural ties to the land of his birth. Native-born Americans suspect that it is they, and not the immigrant, who are being forced to adapt. In this way, the immigration debate comes to signify not a loss of jobs, but a loss of sovereignty. Just one more example, like September 11th, the bird flu, computer viruses, and plants moving to China, that America seems unable to control its own destiny. I attended a naturalization workshop at St. Pius Church in Chicago, sponsored by Congressman Luis Gutierrez, the Service Employees International Union, and several immigrant rights groups. About 1,000 people had lined up outside the church, young families, elderly couples, and women with strollers. Inside, people sat silently in wooden pews, clutching the small American flags that the organizers had passed out, waiting to be called by one of the volunteers who would help them manage the start of what would be a years-long process to become citizens. At one point, a young girl, 7 or 8, came up to me, her parents standing behind her, and asked me for an autograph. She was studying government in school, she said, and would show it to her class. She said her name was Christina, and that she was in the 3rd grade. I told her parents they should be proud of her. And as I watched Christina translate my words into Spanish for them, I was reminded that America has nothing to fear from these newcomers, that they have come here for the same reason that families came here 150 years ago. All those who fled Europe's famines and wars and unyielding hierarchies, all those who may not have had the right legal documents or connections or unique skills to offer, but who carried with them a hope for a better life. We have a right and duty to protect our borders. We can insist to those already here that with citizenship come obligations to a common language, common loyalties, a common purpose, a common destiny. But ultimately, the danger to our way of life is not that we will be overrun by those who do not look like us or do not yet speak our language. The danger will come if we fail to recognize the humanity of Christina and her family, if we withhold from them the rights and opportunities that we take for granted, and tolerate the hypocrisy of a servant class in our midst, or, more broadly, if we stand idly by as America continues to become increasingly unequal, an inequality that tracks racial lines and therefore feeds racial strife, and that, as the country becomes more black and brown, neither our democracy nor our economy can long withstand. That's not the future I want for Christina, I said to myself as I watched her and her family wave goodbye. That's not the future I want for my daughters. Their America will be more dizzying in its diversity, its culture more polyglot. My daughters will learn Spanish and be the better for it. Christina will learn about Rosa Parks and understand that the life of a black seamstress speaks to her own. The issues my girls and Christina confront may lack the stark moral clarity of a segregated bus, but in one form or another, their generation will surely be tested, just as Mrs. Parks was tested, and the Freedom Riders were tested, just as we are all tested, by those voices that would divide us and have us turn on each other. And when they are tested in that way, I hope they will have all read about the history of this country and will recognize they have been given something precious. America is big enough to accommodate all their dreams. Chapter 8. Family. By the start of my 2nd year, my life in the Senate had settled into manageable rhythm. I would leave Chicago Monday night or early Tuesday morning, depending on the Senate's voting schedule. Other than daily trips to the Senate gym or the rare lunch or dinner with a friend, the next 3 days would be consumed in a predictable series of tasks: committee markups, votes, caucus lunches, floor statements, speeches, photos with interns, evening fundraisers, returning phone calls, writing correspondence, reviewing legislation, drafting op-eds, recording podcasts, receiving policy briefings, hosting constituent coffees, and an endless series of meetings. On Thursday afternoon, we would get word from the cloakroom as to what time the last vote would be. And at the appointed hour, I'd line up in the well of the Senate alongside my colleagues to cast my vote before trotting down the Capitol steps in hopes of catching a flight that would get me home before the girls went to bed. The work itself I found fascinating, if occasionally frustrating. Only a couple dozen standalone bills even get called for a roll call vote on the Senate floor every year, and almost none of those are sponsored by a member of the minority party. As a result, most of my major initiatives, the formation of public school innovation districts, a plan to help U.S. automakers pay for their retiree health care costs in exchange for increased fuel economy standards, an expansion of the Pell Grant program to help low-income students meet rising college tuition costs, languished in committee. On the other hand, thanks to great work by my staff, I'd managed to get a respectable number of amendments passed. We'd made it easier for veterans to press for their disability claims. We provided tax credits to gas stations for installing E85 fuel pumps. We passed an amendment through the Senate eliminating no-bid contracts in the Katrina reconstruction, so more money would actually end up in the hands of the tragedy's victims. None of these amendments would transform the country. Some were highly technical, and almost all went largely unnoticed. But I took satisfaction in knowing that each of them helped some people in a modest way, or nudged the law in a direction that might prove to be more economical, more responsible, or more just. One day in February, I found myself in particularly good spirits, having just had a hearing on legislation I had sponsored with Republican Senator Dick Lugar of Indiana, aimed at restricting weapons proliferation and the black market arms trade. Because Dick was not only the Senate's leading expert on proliferation issues, but also happened to be the chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, prospects for the bill seemed promising. Wanting to share the good news, I called Michelle from my D.C. office and started explaining the significance of the bill, how shoulder-to-air missiles could threaten commercial air travel if they fell into the wrong hands, how small arms stockpiles left over from the Cold War continued to feed conflict across the globe. Michelle cut me off. "We have ants," she said. "Huh?" "I found ants in the kitchen, Barack, and in the bathroom upstairs." "Okay. I need you to go buy some ant traps on your way home tomorrow," she said. "I'd get them myself, but I've got to take the girls to their doctor's appointments after school. Can you do that for me?" "Right," I said. "Ant traps." "Ant traps," she repeated. "Don't forget, okay, honey? And buy more than just one. Listen, I need to go into a meeting. Love you." I hung up the receiver, wondering if Ted Kennedy or John McCain bought ant traps on the way home from work. Most people who meet my wife quickly conclude that she is remarkable. They are right about this. She is smart, funny, beautiful, and thoroughly charming. Often, after hearing her speak at some function or working with her on a project, people will approach me and say something to the effect of, "You know, I think the world of you, Barack, but your wife, wow." I nod, knowing that if I ever had to run against her for public office, she would beat me without much difficulty. I met Michelle in the summer of 1988, while we were both working at Sidley & Austin, a large corporate law firm based out of Chicago. Although she is 3 years younger than me, Michelle was already a practicing lawyer by that time, having attended Harvard Law straight out of college. I had just finished my first year at law school and been hired as a summer associate. It was a difficult transitional period in my life. I had enrolled in law school after 3 years of work as a community organizer, and although I enjoyed my studies, I still harbored occasional doubts about my decision. Privately, I worried that it represented the abandonment of my youthful ideals, a concession to the hard realities of money and power, the world as it is, rather than the world as it should be. The idea of working at a corporate law firm, so near and yet so far removed from the poor neighborhoods where my friends were still laboring, only worsened these fears. But with student loans rapidly mounting, I was in no position to turn down the 3 months of salary Sidley was offering. And so, having sublet the cheapest apartment I could find, having purchased the first 3 suits ever to appear in my closet, and a new pair of shoes that turned out to be a half size too small and would absolutely cripple me for the next 9 weeks, I arrived at the firm one drizzly morning in early June and was directed to the office of the young attorney who'd been assigned to serve as my summer advisor. I don't remember the details of that first conversation with Michelle. I remember that she was tall, almost my height in heels, and lovely, with a friendly professional manner that matched her tailored suit and blouse. She explained how work was assigned at the firm, the nature of the various practice groups, and how to log our billable hours. After showing me my office and giving me a tour of the library, she handed me off to one of the partners and told me that she would meet me for lunch. Later, Michelle would tell me that she had been pleasantly surprised when I walked into her office. The drugstore snapshot that I'd sent in for the firm directory made my nose look a little big, even more enormous than usual, she might say. And she had been skeptical when the secretaries who'd seen me during my interview told her I was cute. I figured that they were just impressed with any black man with a suit and a job, Michelle says. But if Michelle was impressed, she certainly didn't tip her hand when we went out to lunch. I did learn that she had grown up on the South Side. She had attended Bryn Mawr Public Elementary School, gotten into Whitney Young Magnet School, and followed her brother to Princeton, where he had been a star on the basketball team. At Sidley, she was part of the Intellectual Property Group and specialized in entertainment law. At some point, she said, she might have to consider moving to Los Angeles or New York to pursue her career. Oh, Michelle was full of plans that day, on the fast track, with no time, she told me, for distractions, especially men. But she knew how to laugh, brightly and easily, and I noticed she didn't seem in too much of a hurry to get back to the office. And there was something else, a glimmer that danced across her round, dark eyes whenever I looked at her, the slightest hint of uncertainty. As if, deep inside, she knew how fragile things really were, and that if she ever let go, even for a moment, all her plans might quickly unravel. That touched me somehow, that trace of vulnerability. I wanted to know that part of her. For the next several weeks, we saw each other every day, in the law library or cafeteria, or at one of the many outings that law firms throw for their summer associates to convince them that their life in the law will not be endless hours of poring through documents. She took me to one or two parties, tactfully overlooking my limited wardrobe, and even tried to set me up with a couple of her friends. Still, she refused to go out on a proper date. It wasn't appropriate, she said, since she was my advisor. That's a poor excuse, I told her. Really, what advice are you giving me? You're showing me how the copy machine works. You're telling me what restaurants to try. I don't think the partners will consider one date a serious breach in firm policy. She shook her head. Sorry. Okay, I'll quit. How's that? You're my advisor. Tell me who I have to talk to. Eventually, I wore her down. After a firm picnic, she drove me back to my apartment, and I offered to buy her an ice cream cone at the Baskin-Robbins across the street. We sat on the curb and ate our cones in the sticky afternoon heat, and I told her about working at Baskin-Robbins when I was a teenager, and how it was hard to look cool with a brown apron and cap. She told me that for a span of 2 or 3 years as a child, she had refused to eat anything except peanut butter and jelly. I said that I'd like to meet her family. She said that she would like that. I asked her if I could kiss her. It tasted of chocolate. We spent the rest of the summer together. I told her about organizing and living in Indonesia and what it was like to body surf. She told me about her childhood friends and a trip to Paris she'd taken in high school and her favorite Stevie Wonder songs. But it wasn't until I met Michelle's family that I began to understand her. It turned out that visiting the Robinson household was like dropping in on the set of Leave It to Beaver. There was Frasier, the kindly, good-humored father, who never missed a day of work and never missed one of his son's ball games. There was Marion, the pretty, sensible mother who baked birthday cakes, kept order in the house, had volunteered at the school to make sure her children were behaving, and that the teachers were doing what they were supposed to be doing. There was Craig, the basketball star brother, tall and friendly and courteous and funny, working as an investment banker, but dreaming of going into coaching someday. What made this vision of domestic bliss all the more impressive was the fact that the Robinsons had had to overcome hardships that one rarely saw on primetime TV. There were the usual issues of race, of course, the limited opportunities available to Michelle's parents growing up in Chicago during the 50s and 60s, the racial steering and panic peddling that had driven white families away from their neighborhood, the extra energy required from black parents to compensate for smaller incomes and more violent streets and underfunded playgrounds and indifferent schools. But there was a more specific tragedy at the center of the Robinson household. At the age of 30, in the prime of his life, Michelle's father had been struck with multiple sclerosis. For the next 25 years, as his condition steadily deteriorated, he had carried out his responsibilities to his family without a trace of self-pity, giving himself an extra hour every morning to get to work, struggling with every physical act, from driving a car to buttoning his shirt, smiling and joking as he labored, at first with a limp, and eventually with the aid of two canes, his balding head beating with sweat, across a field to watch his son play, or across the living room to give his daughter a kiss. After we were married, Michelle would help me understand the hidden toll that her father's illness had taken on her family, how heavy a burden Michelle's mother had been forced to carry, how carefully circumscribed their lives together had been, with even the smallest outing planned out to avoid problems or awkwardness, how terrifyingly random life must have seemed beneath the smiles and laughter. But I saw only the joy of the Robinson house. For someone like me who had barely known his father, who had spent much of his life traveling from place to place, his bloodline scattered to the four winds, the home that Frazier and Marion Robinson had built for themselves stirred a longing for stability, a sense of place, that I had not realized was there. Just as Michelle perhaps saw in me a life of adventure, risk, travel to exotic lands, a wider horizon than she had previously allowed herself. 6 months after Michelle and I met, her father died suddenly of complications after a kidney operation. I flew back to Chicago and stood at his gravesite, Michelle's head on my shoulder. As the casket was lowered, I promised Frazier Robinson that I would take care of his girl. I realized that in some unspoken, still tentative way, Michelle and I were already becoming a family. There's a lot of talk these days about the decline of the American family. Social conservatives claim that the traditional family unit is under assault from Hollywood movies and gay pride parades. Liberals point to the economic factors, from stagnating wages to inadequate daycare, that have put families under increasing duress. Our popular culture feeds the alarm with tales of women consigned to permanent singlehood, men unwilling to make lasting commitments, and teens engaged in endless sexual escapades. Nothing seems settled, as it was in the past. Our roles and relationships all feel up for grabs. Given this hand-wringing, it may be helpful to step back and remind ourselves that the institution of marriage isn't disappearing anytime soon. While it's true that marriage rates have declined steadily since the 1950s, some of the statistical change is a result of more Americans delaying marriage to pursue an education or establish a career. Married couples continue to head 67% of American families, and the vast majority of Americans still consider marriage to be the best foundation for personal intimacy, economic stability, and child-rearing. Still, there's no denying that the nature of the family has changed over the last 50 years. Although divorce rates have declined by 26% since their peak in the late 70s and early 80s, half of all first marriages still end in divorce. Compared to our grandparents, we're more tolerant of premarital sex, more likely to cohabit, and more likely to live alone. We're also far more likely to be raising children in non-traditional households. 60% of all divorces involve children. 1/3 of all children are born out of wedlock. And 40% of children don't live with their biological fathers. For adults, at least, the effect of these changing norms is a mixed bag. Research suggests that on average, married couples live healthier, wealthier, and happier lives. But no one claims that men and women would benefit from being trapped in bad or abusive marriages. Whatever the effect on adults, though, the social science indicates that these trends haven't been so good for our children. Many single moms, including the one who raised me, do a heroic job on behalf of their kids. But statistically, children living with single mothers are 5 times more likely to be poor than children in two-parent households. Children in single-parent homes are also more likely to drop out of school and become teen parents. And the evidence suggests that on average, children who live with both their biological mother and father do better than those who live in step-families or with cohabiting partners. In light of these facts, policies that strengthen marriage for those who choose it and that discourage unintended births outside of marriage are sensible goals to pursue. For example, most people agree that neither federal welfare programs nor the tax code should penalize married couples. Those aspects of Clinton's welfare reform plan and the Bush tax plan that reduced the marriage penalty enjoy strong bipartisan support. The same goes for teen pregnancy prevention. Everyone agrees that teen pregnancies place both mother and child at risk for all sorts of problems. Since 1990, the teen pregnancy rate has dropped by 20%. But teens still account for almost a quarter of out-of-wedlock births, and teen mothers are much more likely to have additional out-of-wedlock births as they get older. Those community-based programs that have a proven track record in preventing unwanted pregnancies, both by encouraging abstinence and by promoting the proper use of contraception, deserve broad support. But for many social conservatives, these common-sense approaches don't go far enough. They want to return to a bygone era in which sexuality outside of marriage was subject to both punishment and shame. Obtaining a divorce was far more difficult, and marriage offered not merely personal fulfillment, but also well-defined social roles for men and for women. In their view, any government policy that appears to reward or express neutrality toward what they consider to be immoral behavior, whether providing birth control to young people, abortion services to women, welfare support for unwed mothers, or legal recognition of same-sex unions, inherently devalue the marital bond. Such policies take us one step closer, the argument goes, to a brave new world in which gender differences have been erased, sex is merely recreational, marriage is disposable, motherhood is an inconvenience, and civilization itself rests on shifting sands. I understand the impulse to restore a sense of order to a culture that's constantly in flux. And I certainly appreciate the desire of parents to shield their children from values they consider unwholesome. It's a feeling I share when I hear half of the song lyrics playing on the radio. But all in all, I have little sympathy for those who would enlist the government in the task of enforcing sexual morality. Like most Americans, I consider decisions about sex, marriage, divorce, and childbearing to be highly personal, at the very core of our system of individual liberty. Where such personal decisions raise the prospect of significant harm to others, as is true with child abuse, incest, bigamy, domestic violence, or failure to pay child support, society has a right and duty to step in. Beyond that, I have no interest in seeing the president, Congress, or a government bureaucracy regulating what goes on in America's bedrooms. Moreover, I don't believe we strengthen the family by bullying or coercing people into the relationships we think are best for them, or by punishing those who fail to meet the conservative standards of sexual propriety. I want to encourage young people to show more reverence towards sex and intimacy, and applaud parents, congregations, or community programs that transmit that message. But I'm not willing to consign a teenage girl to a lifetime of struggle for lack of access to birth control. I want couples to understand the value of commitment and the sacrifices marriage entails. But I'm not willing to use the force of law to keep couples together, regardless of their personal circumstance. Perhaps I just find the ways of the human heart too various, my own life too imperfect, to believe myself qualified to serve as anyone's moral arbiter. I do know that in our 14 years of marriage, Michelle and I have never had an argument as a result of what other people are doing in their relationships. What we have argued about, repeatedly, is how to balance work and family in a way that's equitable to Michelle and good for our kids. We're not alone in this. In the 60s and early 70s, the household Michelle grew up in was the norm. Over 70% of families had mom at home and relied on dad as the sole breadwinner. Today, those numbers are reversed. 70% of families with children are headed by two working parents or a single working parent. The result has been what my policy director and work-family expert Karen Kornblow calls the juggler family, in which parents struggle to pay the bills, look after their children, maintain a household, and maintain their relationships. Keeping all these balls in the air takes its toll on family life. Many social conservatives suggest that this flood of women out of the home and into the workplace is a direct consequence of feminist ideology, and hence can be reversed, if women will just come to their senses and return to their traditional homemaking roles. It is true, of course, that ideas about equality for women have played a critical role in the transformation of the workplace. In the minds of most Americans, the opportunity for women to pursue careers, achieve economic independence, and realize their talents on an equal footing with men has been one of the great achievements of modern life. But for the average American woman, the decision to work isn't simply a matter of changing attitudes. A changing economy has given them little choice. Over the last 30 years, the average earnings of American men have grown less than 1% once adjusted for inflation. Meanwhile, the cost of everything, from housing to healthcare to education, has steadily risen. What has kept a large swath of American families from falling out of the middle class has been mom's paycheck. For most families, keeping mom at home can be accomplished only by living in a less safe neighborhood and enrolling their kids in a less competitive school. That's not a choice most Americans are willing to make. Instead, they do the best they can under the circumstances, knowing that the type of household they grew up in, the type of household in which Frazier and Marion Robinson raised their kids, has become much, much harder to sustain. Both men and women have had to adjust to these new realities, but it's hard to argue with Michelle when she insists that the burden of the modern family falls more heavily on the woman. For the first few years of our marriage, Michelle and I went through the usual adjustments all couples go through, learning to read each other's moods, accepting the quirks and habits of any stranger in your midst. Michelle liked to wake up early and could barely keep her eyes open after 10 o'clock. I was a night owl and could be a bit grumpy. Mean, Michelle would say, within the first half hour or so of getting out of bed. Partly because I was still working on my first book, and perhaps because I had lived much of my life as an only child, I would often spend the evening holed up in my office in the back of our railroad apartment. What I considered normal, Michelle often felt as loneliness. I invariably left the butter out after breakfast and forgot to twist the little tie around the bread bag. Michelle could rack up parking tickets like nobody's business. Mostly, though, those early years were full of ordinary pleasures, going to movies, having dinner with friends, catching the occasional concert. We were both working hard. I was practicing law at a small civil rights firm and had started teaching at the University of Chicago Law School, while Michelle had decided to leave her law practice, first to work in the city's Department of Planning, and then to run the Chicago branch of a national service program called Public Allies. Our time together got squeezed even more when I ran for the state legislature. But despite my lengthy absences and her general distaste for politics, Michelle supported the decision. "I know it's something you want to do," she would tell me. On the nights that I was in Springfield, we'd talk and laugh over the phone, sharing the humor and frustrations of our days apart, and I would fall asleep content in the knowledge of our love. Then Malia was born, a 4th of July baby, so calm and so beautiful, with big, hypnotic eyes that seemed to read the world the moment they opened. Malia's arrival came at an ideal time for both of us. Because I was out of session and didn't have to teach during the summer, I was able to spend every evening at home. Meanwhile, Michelle had decided to accept a part-time job at the university, so she could spend more time with the baby, and the new job didn't start till October. For 3 magical months, the two of us fussed and fretted over our new baby, checking the crib to make sure she was breathing, coaxing smiles from her and singing her songs, taking so many pictures we started wondering if we were damaging her eyes. Suddenly, our different biorhythms came in handy. While Michelle got some well-earned sleep, I would stay up until 1 or 2 in the morning, changing diapers, heating breast milk, feeling my daughter's soft breath against my chest as I rocked her to sleep, guessing at her infant dreams. But when fall came, when my classes started back up, the legislature went back into session, and Michelle went back to work, the strains in our relationship began to show. I was often gone for 3 days at a stretch. Even when I was back in Chicago, I might have evening meetings to attend, or papers to grade, or briefs to write. Michelle found that a part-time job had a funny way of expanding itself. We found a wonderful in-home babysitter to look after Malia while we were at work, but with a full-time employee suddenly on our payroll, money got tight. Tired and stressed, We had less time for conversation, much less romance. When I launched my ill-fated congressional run, Michelle put up no pretense of being happy with the decision. My failure to clean up the kitchen suddenly became less endearing. Leaning down to kiss Michelle goodbye in the morning, all I would get was a peck on the cheek. By the time Sasha was born, just as beautiful and almost as calm as her sister, my wife's anger toward me seemed barely contained. "You only think about yourself," she would tell me. "I never thought I'd have to raise a family alone." I was stung by such accusations. I thought she was being unfair. After all, it wasn't as if I went carousing with the boys every night. I made few demands of Michelle. I didn't expect her to darn my socks or have dinner waiting for me when I got home. Whenever I could, I pitched in with the kids. All I asked for was a little tenderness when I came home. Instead, I found myself subjected to endless negotiations about every detail of managing the house, long lists of things that I needed to do or had forgotten to do, and a generally sour attitude. I reminded Michelle that compared to most families, we were incredibly lucky. I reminded her as well that for all my flaws, I loved her and the girls more than anything else. My love should be enough, I thought. As far as I was concerned, she had nothing to complain about. It was only upon reflection, after the trials of those years had passed and the kids were off to school, that I began to appreciate what Michelle was going through at the time. The struggles so typical of today's working mom. For no matter how liberated I like to think of myself, no matter how much I told myself that Michelle and I were equal partners, and that her dreams and ambitions were as important as my own, the fact was that when children showed up, it was Michelle and not me who was expected to make the necessary adjustments. Sure, I helped, but it was always on my terms, on my schedule. Meanwhile, she was the one who had to put her career on hold. She was the one who had to make sure that the kids were fed and bathed every night. If Malia or Sasha got sick, or the babysitter failed to show up, it was she who, more often than not, had to get on the phone to cancel a meeting at work. It wasn't just the constant scrambling between her work and her children that made Michelle's situation so tough. It was also the fact that from her perspective, she wasn't doing either job well. This was not true, of course. Her employers loved her, and everyone remarked on what a good mother she was. But I came to see that in her own mind, two visions of herself were at war with each other. The desire to be the woman her mother had been, solid, dependable, making a home and always there for her kids, and the desire to excel in her profession, to make her mark on the world, and realize all those plans she'd had on the very first day that we met. In the end, I credit Michelle's strength, her willingness to manage these tensions and make sacrifices on behalf of myself and the girls, with carrying us through the difficult times. But we also had resources at our disposal that many American families simply don't have. For starters, Michelle's and my status as professionals meant that we could rework our schedules to handle an emergency, or just take a day off, without risk of losing our jobs. Most American workers don't have that luxury. Indeed, the majority of workers can't take a day off to look after a child without losing pay or using vacation days. For parents who do try to make their own schedule, flexibility is often purchased by accepting part-time or temporary work with no career ladder and few or no benefits. Michelle and I also had enough income to cover all the services that help ease the pressures of two-earner parenthood. Reliable childcare, extra babysitting whenever we needed it, takeout dinners when we had neither the time nor the energy to cook, someone to come in and clean the house once a week, and private preschool and summer day camp once the kids were old enough. For most American families, such help is financially out of reach. The cost of daycare is especially prohibitive. The United States is practically alone among Western nations in not providing government-subsidized, high-quality daycare services to all of its workers. If we're serious about family values, then we can put policies in place that make the juggling of work and parenting a little bit easier. We could start by making high-quality daycare affordable for every family that needs it. It's also time to redesign our schools, not just for the sake of working parents, but also to help prepare our children for a more competitive world. Most of all, we need to work with employers to increase the flexibility of work schedules. Already, many larger companies offer formal flex-time programs, and report increased employee morale and decreased employee turnover as a result. With a combination of innovative policymaking, technical assistance, and greater public awareness, government can help businesses do right by their employees at nominal expense. Of course, none of these policies preclude the possibility that more families decide to keep a parent at home, regardless of the financial sacrifices. For some families, that may mean doing without certain material comforts. For others, it may mean homeschooling or a move to a community where the cost of living is lower. For some families, it may be the father who stays at home, although for most families, it will still be the mother who serves as the primary caregiver. Whatever the case may be, such decisions should be honored. If there's one thing that social conservatives have been right about, it's that our modern culture sometimes fails to fully appreciate the extraordinary emotional and financial contributions, the sacrifices, and just plain hard work of the stay-at-home mom. Where social conservatives have been wrong is to insist that this traditional role is innate, the best or only model of motherhood. I want my daughters to have a choice, a say, over what's best for them and their families. And that requires not just a change in attitudes among women. As Michelle has taught me, it also requires men to see women differently. Hi, Daddy. Hey, sweetie pie. It's Friday afternoon, and I'm home early to look after the girls while Michelle goes to the hairdresser. I gather up Malia in a hug and notice a blonde girl in our kitchen, peering at me through a pair of oversized glasses. Who's this? I ask, setting Malia back on the floor. This is Sam. She's over for a play date. Hi, Sam. I offer Sam my hand, and she considers it for a moment before shaking it loosely. Malia rolls her eyes. Listen, Daddy, you don't shake hands with kids.
You don't?
No, Malia says. Not even teenagers shake hands. You may not have noticed, but this is the 21st century. Malia looks at Sam, who represses a smirk.
So what do you do in the 21st century, I ask?
You just say, hey. Sometimes you wave. That's pretty much it.
I see. I hope I didn't embarrass you.
Malia smiles.
That's okay, Daddy. You didn't know, because you're used to shaking hands with grown-ups.
That's true. Where's your sister?
She's upstairs.
I walk upstairs to find Sasha standing in her underwear and a pink top. She pulls me down for a hug, and then tells me she can't find any shorts. I check in the closet and find a pair of blue shorts sitting right on top of her chest of drawers.
What are these? I ask her.
Sasha frowns, but reluctantly takes the shorts from me and pulls them on.
These shorts aren't comfortable, Daddy.
We go back into Sasha's closet, open the drawer again, and find another pair of shorts, also blue.
How about these? I ask.
Sasha frowns again. Standing there, she looks like a 3-foot version of her mother. Malia and Sam walk in to observe the standoff.
Sasha doesn't like either of those shorts, Malia explains.
I turn to Sasha and ask her why. She looks up at me warily, taking my measure.
Pink and blue don't go together, she says finally.
Malia and Sam giggle. I try to look as stern as Michelle might look in such circumstances, and tell Sasha to put on the shorts. She does what I say, but I realize she's just indulging me. When it comes to my daughters, no one is buying my tough guy routine. Like many men today, I grew up without a father in the house. My mother and father divorced when I was only 2 years old, and for most of my life I knew my father only through the letters he sent and the stories my mother and grandparents told. There were men in my life, the stepfather with whom we lived for 4 years, and my grandfather, who along with my grandmother helped raise me the rest of the time, and both were good men who treated me with affection. But my relationships with them were necessarily partial, incomplete. In the case of my stepfather, this was a result of limited duration and his natural reserve. And as close as I was to my grandfather, he was both too old and too troubled to provide me with much direction. It was women, then, who provided the ballast in my life. My grandmother, whose dogged practicality kept the family afloat. And my mother, whose love and clarity of spirit kept my sisters and my world centered. Because of them, I never went wanting for anything important. Through them, I would receive the values that guide me to this day.
Still, as I got older, I came to recognize how hard it had been for my mother and grandmother to raise us without a strong male presence in the house. I felt as well the mark that a father's absence can leave on a child. I determined that my father's irresponsibility towards his children, my stepfather's remoteness,